Session number 22371, Reel 6.
John Howe, Reel 6.
Okay. So, I remember we went down and got on a train, and I was to take the vehicle party across India, and all the men, officers and men, who were not in that, went on a passenger train. Now we loaded up this train and we took off from Bombay station at about midnight. The army never does anything in a civilized time anyway, and at the last minute, just before the train pulled out, someone came along with a big envelope and shoved it in my hand and said, here's the instructions for OC train, that's you. So I said, well, thanks very much. Well, anyway, there was a party of two lieutenants and a couple of dozen men. The train was railway flats, and a jeep and a gun was, occupied a flat. You can think what I mean. So you only had to put down a couple of planks and you could drive from one flat onto another, so you could drive the length of the train. That's how it was loaded and eventually unloaded. And the planks were quite substantial, of course. Anyway, we then thundered off into the night. And it's quite interesting. In the heat of Bombay, you climb up through some mountains called the Ghats. And it's quite cold up there, remember? And we sort of snuggled down. I came to you next morning and the train was just trundling along, having gone through the mountains on the plains the other side. And time went on and we all get a bit hungry. So I went back down the train. You see, it wasn't going very fast, so you just jump from one flat to the next as you got back to the guard. And I said, here, what about stopping for breakfast? And he said, I've been waiting for you to tell me. And he said, well, no, the train doesn't stop till you decide. So I said, we'll have breakfast now then. And he said, it was a very nice place in 2 miles or something, so we went on. And we stopped and we had breakfast. And I thought, well, I'd better read these instructions to OC train. That's a good job I did. I found that the dominance of the army in India, or the Indian army in India, was that the OC train has complete command of that train, including the drivers, the guards, and in fact, well, he wasn't responsible, he could command considerable things to do with the railway. A train may not start or stop without his permission. Obviously it can stop, but it couldn't start. So if it was stop somewhere, the guard said, is it okay to start now? And I'd say, yes, I'll forget it. I didn't mind this. It was all part of the act. There were two lieutenants, as I say, and all these men, and we trundled on. I suppose we stopped for lunch. And it was quite interesting seeing the Indian countryside that we went through, with a great variety. And we saw elephants working, maybe wild, I don't know. Peasants working in the fields, and jungle, and a mixture. It took four and a half days to get to Calcutta, so we had plenty of time to observe the countryside. Anyway, on that first day, I worked my way along the train. When I got to the front, I found everybody was busy beating out fires. Now, the Indian trains at that time were running on wood, or probably a mixture of coal and wood, and this threw out sparks. And so as the engine went along, the sparks came out and they were landing on canvas or anything else. And with vehicles with petrol in them, ammunition, things like that. Not to mention men and their clothes and their lives and so on. It was really much fun. Anyway, we had no alternative but to keep on going. You know, and I kept a party up there just to beat out any spark that fell. Well, there were quite a few. I went through and saw the guard, and he said, well, you'll have to see the station master in Jhansi. So later that day we arrived at Jhansi, which is a big railway junction. And we stopped right in the middle of the station. I don't know why, but it seemed to be a good place. So I went off to find the station master, armed with my copy of instructions for OC train, having read them. And I pointed out to him this problem we had with the sparks from his engine, and could he put a couple of empty trucks in between us and the engine, because only the first couple of flats that had this problem. And he flatly refused. In fact, he refused in very aggressive terms. So I said, well, in that case, my train will stop in the middle of your station and will stay there until you do it. And to my astonishment, we got those two empty trucks as fast as he could organise them. You couldn't have done anything like that in England. It's very strange. That's how you behaved, you see. Anyway, we got him, and from then on we had no problem. And really, it was a very pleasant trip across India. Now, we arrived at Calcutta, on the outskirts of Calcutta, quite early one morning, you know, after dawn. And Calcutta sort of came up out of the mists. And there was a very tall building, I suppose. It was a chimney. It might have been a tower of some sort. And you could see lettering on it. And as you got close, you could read the lettering. And it was written all the way down this tower. And it said, gonorrhea. They don't have any inhibitions about things like this in India. I mean, again, that was a difference. It caused quite a lot of amusement. Anyway, we tunnelled into Calcutta sidings, I suppose. The rest of the battery, which had gone on by passenger train, were already there in some camp or other. And they had a party who met us. And rather late that day, I can remember it was getting dark, we unloaded the vehicles. You had to drive each vehicle and tow its gun the length of the train, and you had these sort of these planks which you put down and made a bridge at each, at the end of each flat. Anyway, the fullness of time, we were unloaded. I went to that camp, and I suppose the next morning we went down to the docks and loaded the ship. We would have been happy loading the ship, however, we were not allowed to, because there were union rules, and so the local coolies had to do it. They were in no hurry. What they did is that the ship with its derricks just dropped a great net on the ground, and you drove onto the net and pulled it up. And we had men up on the ship who put it in position and in the hold. I was highly suspicious of the whole exercise, so mounted a guard, both on the quayside and on the and inside the ship to prevent robbery. And we went on until we had finished loading. Then the hold was sealed, and the guard was withdrawn. It didn't make any difference. They got in there and robbed. Or most personal possessions went. They went through everything.
What's it aroused your suspicions in the first place?
I was just apprehensive. There's a lot of shifty characters around the place. Well, strange country, strange customs. Robbery was, anyway, I don't know now, certainly was something that you had to be aware of in India. You see, everything was wide open. You pretended to live in bungalows or, huts that were one story with windows that had no panes of glass in them. There was a bit of a roof to stop the rain coming down. But everything was wide open. I'm not sure we even had doors. We probably did. I found a robber in my bedroom one night. He's out that window before he could say Jack. and that was not an uncommon occurrence. So you were a bit apprehensive about things like this. Anyway, I think we then had a night in Calcutta. And we certainly had time to look around Calcutta. And the next morning we went down and got on board the ship, which was a cargo ship. It may have been a Liberty ship, I'm not quite sure, but it was essentially a cargo ship with a British crew, a Scots engineer and, you know, captain and mate and all the rest of it. And I was a sea ship. Now, when they started to go through the procedure to get the ship away from the dock, all of a sudden a jeep screamed up just before the last gangway was lifted, and he rushed up with a sort of big carton and dropped it on the desks and said, "This is your entertainment box, comfort box." Mm-hmm. And he pushed off and just got off the ship in time before they lifted the gangway. Probably had to jump for it, for I don't know if it was that close. And we trundled off. By that time it was evening. And we trundled off and went down. You know, Calcutta's a long way upriver. And it's quite interesting, you know, in the gathering dusk, going down this river, Hooghly. And anyway, before we knew it, we were out in the Indian Ocean. It took a week to get down to Singapore, or several days, anyway.
What was in your comfort box?
The first morning, when it was daylight, we got this comfort box open. And there was something like about 24 games of Ludo. Highly intellectual pursuit. We had Ludo competitions, Ludo... You know, you think some bloke went all the trouble of rushing down there to this box of the Ludo. Anyway, the other end of the boat, see, we had the forecastle end, and the men had, I suppose they had bunks, and the officers had a little cabin, which he shared with an Indian lieutenant. Although he spoke good English, communication with him was extremely difficult. He was not a talkative character. I would quite have enjoyed talking to him, but he had no wish to discuss anything with us. Now, he had about 120 men who were... Who were lodged in the top end of the hold, on bunk beds, bunk beds. And they had a toilet which was rigged to the outside of the ship with running water that just flushed it all into the ocean. The water's supposed to be running all the time. These blokes always used to turn the water off. It was a great mess.
Which blokes?
The Indians. Yeah. Anyway, each morning the mate used to inspect his ship, and as OC ship I had to go around with him. And we knew that when we got up the Indian end, I don't know whether it was some religious observance or whatever it was, but they were just piles of shit, they never washed it away. Now, we used to turn this... The hose came through with considerable pressure, you know, in a trough, and it just blew the whole thing out. And it was difficult to get these Indians out of their bunks. What they needed was fresh air, but they lay down there and they were sick. And they were poor travellers, generally, and I think they were miserable at leaving India. And their lieutenant was miserable. And they were an unhappy lot. Not much I could do about them. I didn't speak their language either.
Which regiment was this?
I don't remember. No, I can't remember at all.
But infantry?
I'm not even sure of that now. I rather think that they were Service Corps or something like that. It was hard work getting anything out of this Indian officer, so presumably we knew who he was, but the conversation didn't flow. Anyway, the trip down, the Survey of Bengal there, you know, it's quite a... It's a lovely part of the world when the weather's reasonable. And it was quite reasonable for that journey. The most beautiful were sunrises and sunsets and... you know, thoroughly enjoyed it. Good view of the heavens, you could see all the stars and constellations. I remember having great arguments about what was an eclipse. I'm sure most people know exactly what an eclipse is, but we decided that we had different points of view of what it was. Anyway, we rolled on down and finally got into Singapore. And I went ashore in a ship's boat. And I think there was a party from the battery ready to meet us. So when the ship came in, and when it was unloaded, and we trundled out to a barracks, which was way out of Singapore, not very far beyond Changi Jail, the famous place. It was called, I think, Selangor Barracks, but it was an enormous barracks, which had clearly been built in the 30s to house probably a couple of battalions with supporting troops. You know, it was a very big barracks. And an enormous parade ground, like a couple of football pitches. Maybe more, but enormous. Now, running down the parade grounds were strips of mud. So there'd be this tarmac adam, you know, a yard or two of it, and then a yard or two of this mud, then a yard or two of tarmac adam, and then another yard or two of mud. These strips went all the way down this lengthy parade ground. And as it rained every day, that was muddy. The buildings, for all that they were comparatively new, had been stripped of every amenity. Light sockets, lights, every bit of plumbing had been removed. There were just holes in the ground. There were just bare walls.
Who had done that?
The Japanese. Well, the prisoners had done it, but the Japanese had done it. And the strange thing was that they then stored this in a warehouse, all these things. And they were there, and we got there, because it takes time to put them in. And we all needed barracks straight away, so we got in on these barracks and lived there for a time. Now, I learnt afterwards, years afterwards, the story of that barracks. Apparently, after the British surrender, except Singapore, the entire garrison of Singapore was taken up and put onto that parade ground. And it was demanded that they should sign a document of some sort. And they refused. And so they were told, in that case, you stay on this barrack square until you sign. Or whatever it is that the Japanese wanted them to do. And so they spent many weeks there. In fact, they stayed there until they were shipped up country to build the railway. Now, dysentery and cholera and all these sort of things were rife. And so they dug latrines with what tools they had, which was penknives and jackknives. And there might have been an entrenching tool or two. But, you know, they dug... And these strips of mud were latrines between areas where they lived. So you can imagine about 100,000 men, you know... And then a latrine area. You can imagine how ghastly that was. All we knew, really, is that to have a morning parade there, somebody stood in the middle of that mud. And that wasn't very nice, because it was great sort of clayey mud that stuck to your boots. Anyway, we weren't there very long. The brigade had occupied Singapore. We were the first garrison of Singapore. We saw some of the prisoners coming through. You know, they brought them down from wherever they were and put them on ships in Singapore. I know the stories you tell about, they said about prisoners are all quite true. There were two prison camps on Singapore Island, and I visited both of them. I mean, Changi Jail is the famous one, which was filled up with Japanese when we were there, as they pulled in these various war criminals.
What did you see of the Japanese prisoners?
Well, I saw them being taken in, put in their cells, saw them in their cells. You know, they look quite inoffensive little men. I'll tell you about that later. I don't remember that we had time to do anything very much. As I said, the brigade had occupied Singapore. There was a unit called the 2nd Forward Observer Unit, known as Tu Fu. And they became the police force of Singapore. There was an artillery unit. Because the police force of Singapore just vanished overnight. They had cooperated wholeheartedly with the Japanese, and they were all put in prison. It's interesting, the police force were all Sikhs, as far as I remember, and the Sikhs had elected to cooperate with the Japanese. So they were stuck in a prison camp. I don't know what happened to them in the end. Anyway, to tell you the truth, the only thing I remember doing there was somebody produced information that there were bodies buried in a bit of scrubland, and we dug them out. They were prisoners of war who'd been shot and just buried there, which wasn't very nice, but life wasn't very nice there. Oh, I know, that's right. I'll tell you what we did. We provided a guard. Now, Lady Mountbatten... Now, to be true, you don't hear a lot about Lady Mountbatten, Lady Edwina Mountbatten. She ran a warehouse down in the docks full of aid, you know, for refugees, and there was no shortage of refugees. There was an organisation called RAPRI, which is a repatriation thing. Quite humorous, too. We always said it stood for return all pretty women immediately. But we were young men. You know. Anyway, we guarded Lady Mountbatten's warehouse, go down. And she came down and visited us and met her. Well, she was a charming lady. I mean, she has a reputation of having been a coquette, so she couldn't help but be charming. It would be second nature to her. Anyway, I heard the story of Lady Mountbatten, which is a story that never seems to get much publicity. But see, when the Japanese surrendered, there were all these prisoners in Changi Jail, and the Japanese sort of said, well, you know, you're all free. They're free, but where are they going to go? You know? And suddenly a plane appeared, and about a dozen parachutists jumped out, just in front of the jail. And they walked up to the jail. And as they were walking up there, the first one took her helmet off. It was Lady Mountbatten. And she had brought the first aid to the prisoners. And I also thought it was a lovely story, but you never, you know, it's the sort of story that you think the press would... Well, they would, anyway. Anybody would make a fuss on. But anyway, I was telling the story. All of a sudden, we were all gathered together again and shipped off to Java, because there was a civil war there, an absurd civil war. There's been a civil war there ever since. The Javanese only knew one thing, the Indonesians knew one thing. They did not intend to be a Dutch colony again. There were no Dutch troops in the area. We were the only troops in the area. And one of the problems of Southeast Asia was getting troops anywhere at any speed at all, because it took ages to get from one place to another. The distances are enormous. And it took something like 2 days to get from Singapore to Java. I know it's only probably a couple of hours' flight by ship, but anyway. So we all went to Batavia. And Batavia had clearly been a prosperous city, but there was no electricity. There was probably running water. It was a city of canals, whether the Dutch needed the canals or just built them for sentimental reasons, I don't know, but it was a city of canals, so there was plenty of water in that place, and it rained every day anyway. It's on the equator. And we hadn't been there more than a day or two before the 5th Power Brigade turned out to do what became known as Kampong Clearing. So we went to the first of these. I went to a place called Kramat Kampong. Tell you the truth, I always equate Kramat Kampong with Bloody Sunday. Now, here's a brigade that had been trained for war and to shoot first and ask questions afterwards. And so we all turned out, fully armed, at dawn. And we were supposed to go through this village and search for arms. It's like an enormous great housing estate, but made of bamboo huts. Mm-hmm. And it was firing very quickly, and the word went round very fast. Nothing to do with radio, this was communication, make it up as you go along, I think. But the brigade commander's driver was shot and killed, and I believe he was. But anyway, the stories grew as they passed around, and they took only a matter of seconds or minutes at the most before everybody heard it. And frankly, from that point on, we had permission to fire. Now, you think about Bloody Sunday, that's what happened there. You see, the parachute regiment are dodging and ducking and weaving, trying to get out of accepting blame for it. But the fact is, once those blokes heard a shot, they had permission to fire, and that's what happened. They were trained to fire. There are other factors, but anyway, I don't know how many Indonesians were killed, but there was never any great fuss.
Did you open fire yourself?
Yep, we did. And we're fired at. We fired at first, to be quite honest.
What were you armed with?
Just ordinary 303 rifles.
What do you think they were firing with?
Similar Japanese rifles. It wasn't a big battle, but there were odd shots. Odd shots in those circumstances is alarming. Anyway.
Did any of your men get hit?
Yes, they did. One of them got shot. I'll come to that. We came to a place where it was necessary to cross a main road. A main road, the sort of main road you'd find in a little village like that, the cart track. But we were wide open, exposed as we crossed it. The way to cross a main road is you get in a bunch, and you go across in a bunch, whang. Before they've got time to react, you're all across. There's always a straggler, and he got shot. He was shot in the leg. At that point, there wasn't time to do a lot of thinking. This bloke lying there in the middle of the road. So I said to my sergeant, whose name was Strong, Sergeant Strong, can give me some covering fire. So there was a lot of firing went on, but it was just to make them keep their heads down. They weren't necessarily firing at any particular thing. And bandaged this bloke up and stopped his bleeding. And I can remember the blood pumping out. I can remember thinking, that's what it says in the books, and blood pumps. I've seen wounded men before, but I've never seen that. And as luck would have it, he was about 6'2", a great big Scotsman, broad shoulders, heavy as hell. He had been useful to the Scots team on Saturday. That type of man. We had to carry this poor devil. We tried carrying him on a gate. It's quite impossible. It's very difficult to carry him on a gate. You can only sort of hold it like this.